From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Joshua Johnson is the host of 1A on NPR, the successor to the long-running and hugely popular Diane Rehm Show. Before his move to the nation's capital, he lived in San Francisco, where he served as KQED's morning newscaster. He's taught courses in podcasting at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Just 2 years ago, he started hosting Truth Be Told for KQED, a show about race in America. Soon after that, literally just a few months, Diane Rehm and WAMU quietly began planning for Rehm's retirement, auditioning hosts. Joshua Johnson was the last to audition. 1A launched in January of 2017. We're not going to spend much time today on his biographical details, as there is far more interesting ground to explore in his thinking, his imagination, and the many fires in his belly. Joshua Johnson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm glad to be here. Glad to hear that your theme is one of my favorite pieces of classical music. That's Jupiter the Bringer of Jollity, isn't it?
That is exactly what it is, Gustav Holst.
Love it. Yes. Absolutely love it.
You are a bringer of jollity, so it's particularly apt today.
We'll see. But thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. And just a reminder, this is a pre-recorded edition of the show, but we will work in some listener questions that came to us early. Is it fair to say, Joshua Johnson, that your launch of Truth Be Told at KQED is what put you on the national radar?
It's part of it. I think that there are so many different moving parts to the way that things happen. The Truth Be Told was what got me on the right radar of the right person to get me to 1A. I think what got me there also included just being able to stay on the path. You know, most people who succeed on the national level, other than the ones who like have the right connection or know the right person, are the ones who just stick it out. There's that old scripture that says the race doesn't go to the fast or the strong, but to the one that runs it to the end. And I was determined to just keep running. Like, I'm going to land somewhere valuable, somewhere special, or die. And if I don't make it, then I need to know that I ran as hard as I could for as long as I could and then kept running. Truth Be Told was the result of being able to run long enough and work hard enough until I got to a place where an opportunity emerged, where the head of news at KQED, a wonderful exec named Holly Kernan, said, the Black Lives Matter movement is erupting all around us. We keep chasing these protests. It's very reactive. I want to be more proactive. Someone come up with something we can do to talk about race in a more proactive way. And I came up with what was originally called So Well Spoken, and what we ultimately called Truth Be Told once Public Radio International said, hey, if you make 4 more episodes, we'll distribute them. So it was partly a matter of just being willing to stay on the path and do the day-to-day work that people here at HQR do all the time. I did the exact same kind of work, features and spots and anchoring and fill-in hosting and just building my skill set until I was ready to do something that I really could create myself.
For a lot of our listeners who haven't heard Truth Be Told, there are going to be parallels. Certainly, it's a national show and it's a discussion on a national level, but Wilmington, southeastern North Carolina, has some pretty interesting historical issues around race, including this is the location of the only documented coup d'etat in American history. So there's a lot of discussion in this region and on this show about race coming at it from different angles. How do you tackle on a national level this complicated, sensitive, too long unspoken, but very subjective subject?
Well, I find that it's always easiest to talk about issues by telling stories. You know, when in doubt, tell a story. Narrative is the way that we understand life. There's a reason why little kids are used to once upon a time. There's a reason that Jesus spoke in parables, because stories make concepts easier. We focus so much in journalism on the 5 W's, who, what, where, when, why. I think we need to add a 6th W to J school when we teach young journalists, and that's well. Because when you ask someone, I don't understand this, what's going on, what happened? They usually start by saying, well, and then they dive in. We tell stories to make sense of life. So when it comes to race, what we did on Truth Be Told and what we do on 1A is try as much as we can to find people with stories about the issues we want to discuss. Because you're the expert on your own life. It's easy to argue somebody's points. It's hard to argue somebody's perspective on their own life. And it humanizes people. Now, that can be really scary. You know, if you're talking about something from a political perspective that someone doesn't like, the critique is, well, why are you normalizing this person? Well, the fact of the matter is, if we're having someone tell this story, they're not an outlier. They're probably telling a story that other people could tell. They just happen to be the one we found who was proficient enough to tell it. And humanizing people is not the same as normalizing them, but you have to humanize them to understand them. So whether it's race or class or sexism or gender or any of the hot buttons that we deal with, we find the best way to do it is to find people to tell their stories, to get them to be the experts on their own lives. Then you marry that story with context. You have the guest who says, you know, oh, so-and-so, what did you hear in that story that stood out to you? Well, I heard the same syndrome that's going on with people all over North Carolina, 48% of folks, blah, blah, blah. And then it becomes easier just to hear and to receive. Start with a story. People sharing their own stories, whatever they are, immediately humanizes them, and it makes the topic easier to engage because you have a simpler place to start.
And you started one episode of Truth Be Told with a woman who had applied for a job. She had been told by the employment agency that she was a shoo-in for this job.
I remember, yeah.
She was a woman of color, and then she went to the interview, the in-person interview, and suddenly everything changed. Some weird things happened in the reception area. She was kind of dismissed, and then she was just told that it wasn't the right fit. She was convinced that that was because she was a woman of color.
Right. She had this resume, and this has been borne out in research before, where if you take resumes with the exact same qualifications or even auto loan applications with the exact same information, but you change the name on the application so that one has a name that sounds more mainstream, David Smith or whatever, or Joshua Johnson for that matter, and you make the other one a name that has a uniquely ethnic feel, you know, Dante Jackson or, you know, Naima Jenkins or whatever, that the name on the application that appears to be a person of color is far more likely to be rejected than the more mainstream name. This
Which
is very well borne out.
An expression of studies on implicit bias.
Right.
In this case, you don't know for sure that that's what was driving you don't know what the reasons really were behind why she wasn't the right fit. And you acknowledge that in this discussion. You call yourself a clinician, and you stepped back and said, it sort of looks like this, but we can never really know that for sure. How do you walk that line between embracing this woman's subjective experience and her perception of it, and then saying, but there is this reality that we can't necessarily know?
Well, we've got to be journalists, and we got to stick to what we know. And if we don't actually know what happened, we got to say so. You know, we didn't have a chance to interview the company. We only have her side of the story. Her story does illuminate something that does happen and that's borne out by research, like I said, the study that I mentioned. But we don't know the entire story in this case. One of the things we wanted to do in Truth Be Told was, wherever we could, engage the other side of the conversation and get a dialogue going. Not necessarily between the two parties, but to get both sides of the story. So ideally, what we would have liked to do was contact the company and say, look, you know, this woman said that this happened. You know, we're not trying to, you know, open you up to a lawsuit or anything, but we're going to tell her story. Would you chime in? Even if it was with a statement or a no comment or whatever. And we couldn't get in touch with them. We weren't able. And she also still worked in Silicon Valley. So she was nervous about disclosing what company it was for fear of future professional retribution. But all of that still allowed us a jumping off point to talk about implicit bias. So we just have to lay all our cards on the table, you know, and say, hey, this could have been something else. She might not have been the right candidate. She might have had just a bad interview day. She could have been rude. Like, we don't know. But the fact that this occurred at least gives us a way in to talk about something that we know is real. And it makes the story vivid in a way that allows people to latch on.
When you look back at that show that had this focus of conversations about race in America, is there anything that came out of any of the episodes that you think this is something we need to really understand more deeply, or we need to explore more, or there was this sort of aha moment, like if everybody in the country just understood this?
Well, it wasn't so much a topic as it was the fact that this is the way we chose to do the show. Like I didn't know at the time that using stories as a means to talk about news was going to be, you know, our unique selling proposition for some future thing. It just seemed like a smart way to go. It was a, you know, it was an idea. And I'm not the only one who had this idea for 1A. Like, you know, our team focuses on this. I'm not unique in thinking that. Public radio does this all the time. So I'm not trying to come off as some guru. But I think the main thing that I took from that was, wow, this is a way to talk about anything. Like, you can talk about just about anything if someone is willing to share their personal story, and you can marry that with expertise. So when the time came to talk to WAMU about this new show, whatever it was going to be, I already had an idea in the back pocket. I had a mentality, at least, so that as we began to talk about curating stories and doing voicemails instead of live calls, it gave us more of a way in to make these stories vivid, especially at a time when everybody in America was just screaming to be heard.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with Joshua Johnson, host of 1A on NPR. When we come back from this break, we'll hear more about some of the hard conversations that Joshua Johnson has on 1A, how he grapples with the line between journalism and punditry, and why uncovering the implicit biases of those on his production team are critical to his work. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Joshua Johnson, host of 1A on NPR, is my guest today. If you haven't tuned in, 1A is a wide-ranging public affairs show broadcast live on weekdays here on HQR News from 10 a.m. to noon. This edition of Coastline is pre-recorded today, and so we'll work in listener questions that were sent in before the show as we can. Just before we went to break, we were talking about Truth Be Told and how you incorporate a personal narrative. You find a story as sort of the launching point for tackling a tough issue. And at WHQR's Friday luncheon, you talked about why part of 1A's mission is really to have these hard conversations. So Truth Be Told could have been hard conversations about race. What are some of the hard conversations that you have on 1A?
We're having a lot of hard conversations. I'm clearly in the hard conversation business. I will never go out of business, basically, because I will never run out of hard things to talk about. I mean, right now it's a lot of politics, of course. Politics cuts across everything, but there's so much that's just visceral and painful and rough about politics that everybody's got a point of view on. So that's a large part of the mainstream of what we discuss. We try to take topics out of pop culture where appropriate. We did a week about issues affecting mothers after Mother's Day. We were trying to figure out what one topic we wanted to do for Mother's Day. Couldn't settle on one. And we were like, well, then doggone it, let's do a week. And so we did a special week of programs called Beyond Mother's Day. We're talking about anything. I mean, we can discuss whatever we want. And it doesn't have to be hard stuff. We did an hour on cover songs. You know, we do the 1A Movie Club on a regular basis, and we have done some really fun films. I think it's a matter of finding things that people are activated to discuss. The hard topics are not always easy to talk about until we figure out the way in. If it's just, let's just debate this issue, oh, that can work. We try to find ways to debate issues in a solutions-oriented way, so we're not just kind of wallowing in the problem, especially if it's a social issue, especially if it's a social ill, especially if it's about race or gender or class or sex or sexuality or any of those things. It can be very easy to feel like, oh, this is going to be an hour-long dirge, and this is going to leave me with no hope. we always try to leave people with some sense of where this could go and who's working to make traction on a big issue.
I've heard you talk about why it's important as a journalist to bring more light than heat to an issue. The
Right.
heat has to be there, yes, because that's what sparks people's interest. It's why it's compelling. But today, one of our longtime listeners called me and left a message and said, "Rachel, I know you don't have any control over the national news, but it's wearing me out. And my wife and I just don't listen to WHQR as much as we used to because we can't take it." At Friday's WHQR luncheon, after you spoke, a woman came up to me and said, with tears in her eyes, "My husband is being, he's getting physically ill. He's deteriorating because he's wallowing in the news." And those weren't her words, but she was saying he can't pull himself out of it. It's almost like this gravitational pull that's sucking his life. Those are some pretty dramatic examples of people who are really suffering because of what's happening in the news. Why is it different today in 2018 than it was in, say, 2008 or 1998? What's happening?
Well, let's go back. In 1998, MSNBC and the Fox News Channel were only 2 years old. Facebook had not signed on in 1998. Broadband internet penetration was basically zero across the country. It was almost nothing. In 2008, Facebook was just a baby. Twitter was pretty much new. We had just gone through the heyday of cable news, really the advent after the 9/11 terror attacks, when Fox News Channel became number one and CNN slipped to number two. We were a very different media environment back then. We, in 1998, did not have shows at the top of the ratings like The Colbert Report. The Daily Show wasn't a major presence in 1998. The media landscape was very different. The combined audience for the three nightly newscasts was still, I'm guessing, north of 60 some odd million people per night, if you combine all three, NBC, ABC, CBS. Peter Jennings was still alive. Dan Rather was still on the anchor desk. It was a very different media environment. And the news happened 24 hours a day, but we didn't want it 24 hours a day. We were comfortable having an anchor voice of God come in and tell you what was going on. We read the paper in the morning. If you were super old school, you read the paper in the afternoon as well. Cable news was more of a novelty. After the 9/11 terror attacks, we had a dire need for 24-hour information. We needed to know what was going on a 24-hour basis. It's similar to what happened after the first Gulf War. You know, when CNN broadcast those pictures of bombs over Baghdad, we had a need for it. And that's when CNN rose in prominence and stopped being the chicken noodle network. People took it seriously. After 9/11, people took CNN very differently, and MSNBC and Fox News Channel, and that moment where President Bush stood on the rubble of the World Trade Center and said, "I can hear you, and pretty soon the terrorists who knocked down these buildings will hear all of us soon." And the workers at Ground Zero cheered. The whole nation changed. We owned a measure of fear that was perfectly justified. Fear is a very dangerous constant to deal with as a journalist, because our job is to dispel fear through information. Information should leave you empowered. Knowledge is supposed to be power. When you get a little too much knowledge, the power becomes imbalanced. The power then actually belongs to the network, because they have the power to hold your attention. They have the power to hold you captive to the information, to the worry about the nation and the world and our democracy and what's happening at City Hall. And this ubiquity of information suddenly becomes a smothering blanket. It's this river of content that you can easily drown on. But once you get out, all you remember is getting wet.
So you're saying that our need, our fear is driving our consumption, and our consumption is creating this kind of, it's sucking us into this vortex of all this news. Have world affairs changed?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Are they? Has our national dialogue changed in a way that is causing people to lose hope?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll do you one better in terms of fear. I'll give you some wisdom from Yoda. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. That's that moment when he looks at Anakin and says, I sense much fear in you. Fear is the path to the dark side. So yes, it's all changed. And on top of that, the proliferation of news networks is very different. There are more news networks now than there have ever been. There's talk of Sinclair Broadcasting creating a competitor to the Fox News Channel, possibly farther to the right of Fox. There are international networks around the world, Sky News and Euro News and France 24, TRT World, which is owned by the Turkish government, RT, Russian television, of course, and RT America here in the States. There is so much more information that you can just inhale and inhale and inhale. You can stream Bloomberg television for free on YouTube, 24 hours a day. Whenever you want 24-hour news, just go to YouTube.
So consumers have to become more discriminating and they have to become less passive and take more responsibility when it comes to what they're consuming.
You have to become more discriminating. You have to become less passive. You have to remember that how you see the world depends on where you look. If you are listening to lots and lots and lots and lots of NPR and it's bumming you out, for God's sake, turn off the radio. You don't owe us 24 hours of your time. Like, you're no good to us. You're no good to our democracy if your heart's broken. Go binge Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Please, would you go find some old episodes of Cat Talk and just go laugh along with Click and Clack? Like, you're not doing anyone any good by just force-feeding this information because you have to do something with this. Part of what I think makes people feel despair is that they're just constantly on receive. They're not heard. They're listening, but no one's listening back, which is why, you know, programs like 1A, I think, help provide a little release valve for people because they get heard. If you're upset, go talk. You know, take an edition of Coastline and talk to people who listen to the same thing. And talk about it. Get it out of your system. If you comment on 1A and we don't read your comment, thank you for commenting. But even if we don't read it, go talk. For goodness sake, if it's your wife, if it's a friend, if it's your pastor, do not let the news cycle break your spirit. It's supposed to be empowering and clarifying. But when it reaches that point that it's damaging, shut it off. Walk away. Don't apologize. And when you're ready, come back.
Your psyche is so enmeshed in the complexities of international politics and terrorist threats and what's happening on the national stage and on Capitol Hill. How do you shake it off?
Sometimes I can't. Sometimes I don't have the luxury of shaking it off because I have to remain inside a story for as long as I have to remain in it. I tend to be very good in breaking news situations. I'm the kind of person who, when everything is crazier around me, I tend to get calmer. I didn't cry over the 9/11 terror attacks for about 48 hours after the attacks had happened. I am kind of that way. Like when something really momentous happens, I can hold it because I got to cover it. And then it takes me about 2-3 days to finally get the emotion out of my system. But when I did, I fell apart completely. For me, it depends. Sometimes it's just like, okay, no more news. Boop. And I just put the phone down. I'll just throw it across the room.
Do you ever feel like you're abdicating your work responsibility when you do that?
No. And also, by the way, in terms of being under the news, you are not responsible for being 24/7 aware. My job is to be 24/7 accountable, not 24/7 available. You do not need to be available to the news all the time, but you ought to be accountable to what's happening in your community. That doesn't mean you have to read everything. So I have no compunction about putting down the phone and going to the gym and listening to some loud music and not listening to NPR while I'm trying to lift something heavy. I have no problem getting on my PlayStation 4 Pro and putting on my VR headset and shooting bad guys in cyberspace. I don't apologize for taking naps when I can take a nap. Like, you got to rest. If I'm not well, I'm no good as a journalist. And there are lots of journalists in D.C. right now who are running this treadmill. They're on this hamster wheel, and they cannot get off. I don't know how they do it, but I don't want their job.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Joshua Johnson, host of 1A. We've pre-recorded this interview, and so we're using some questions listeners sent in before the taping. Joshua Johnson, you talked earlier about the difference between normalizing bad behavior and humanizing a person. And you have really taken apart some of Donald Trump's decisions, tweets, public behavior. You talked about the Colbert Report a little earlier, and I think even on 1A, you've referenced the truthiness of, say, Donald Trump's rhetoric. How do you do that without being perceived, and maybe you are, I don't know, as partisan or as anti-Trump? And are you anti-Trump?
Well, no, I'm not anti-Trump. Donald Trump is my president. Period. Like, he's the president of the United States, you know, duly elected until and unless proven otherwise. And, you know, he won. He's president. You know, he's president, period. I think for my part, my job is to be equally incisive with all of our guests and to try to ask challenging questions, no matter who comes in the door, to figure out something I can ask that requires them to push back. And as long as you give it pushback to everybody fairly equally, you're probably fine. Now, granted, there are people who are certain they know where my politics are. The other day, I saw tweets online of people who said that our show was just another neo-Marxist liberal homily, and then someone who said that 1A and Marketplace are the bastions of conservatism on NPR. So I was like, yes, nobody knows. I got him. I got him coming and going. But, you know, once I do that and just make sure I treat everybody more or less equally, then all I have to do is call balls and strikes. If an elected official, whether it's the president or a mayor or whoever, says something that is demonstrably false, I'm not going to act like it's true. Period. Journalism is a binding contract with the truth. If you don't like facts, then hit the bricks. This isn't for you. You're not ready. You can listen to whatever you want, but I'm not going to apologize for keeping this show accurate. And if the president or any other elected official, I don't want to make this too much about Donald Trump because these are principles that are bigger than any one presidency. If any elected official tries to play fast and loose with the truth and we catch them, we have to say so. Like, it's just, it's our responsibility to substantiate it. Now, I think some journalists take a little too much glee in being, you know, the one who comes back with the head of the 14-point buck to put on the wall. I don't get into that. I'm not knocking that, but that's not my style. But I think I am best when I can just say, you know, that is not true. The fact of the matter is, according to so-and-so, it's this. And then if you don't want to hear the truth, I can't help you. But my responsibility is to call it like it is. I get it. Like, if you are invested in a lawmaker, if you're invested in a politician, you put hopes in this person, you don't want to hear that they might be failing you. But that's the tough thing about truth. There's that scripture that says you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. I think that's almost accurate. The truth can make you free, but then it binds you to something else. It binds you to facts. The truth is a very jealous mistress. She does not like to be cheated on. That's why when people act with duplicity, we immediately feel furious over it, like, but the facts are. Truth is binding. Journalism is a binding contract with the truth. And people sometimes prefer the freedom of wishy-washiness. They prefer the freedom of moral equivalence. They prefer the freedom of truthiness instead of truth. Facts are a very narrow strait to traverse. Truthiness, you can go wherever you want to go. And I get it. Once you start wrapping people up in the facts and the reality and the truth, it can feel like a straitjacket. Or it can feel like a very secure way to govern a democracy. Depends on how you look at it.
So part of being faithful to your jealous mistress, the truth, is challenging your own assumptions and challenging your own thinking.
Always.
And, you know, we talked a little bit about implicit biases before. Those are unconscious biases that a lot of us walk around. We all have them in one form or another. How do you find them? How do you unearth them so that you know they're not negatively impacting or you know, degrading the level of truth that you're presenting?
You know, the best ways that I've found, and this is what's hard about them, is you need someone else to point them out because they're your biases. Like, it's like trying to look at the end of your nose. You know that your nose has a tip, but you need something else to reflect it back to you. And so, I've been through a few implicit bias trainings, and they've always gone best when I'm not the one leading it.
So then tell me, what's an example of an implicit bias you discovered you had that you didn't know you had, and somebody pointed it out?
I think one of the ones that is most revelatory for people of color, and I noticed this, I was like, oh, wow, that's real. One of the ones that's most revelatory for people of color, I'll just speak for myself as a black man, is that even black people have the same prejudices against black people that some white people have, that they are cultural and they are marinating around all of us and we are all marinating in them. And the same biases about the way somebody might talk and their cadence and their style of dress and their behavior and the way they walk and the way they look, you know, even black people will have certain perceptions about somebody's educational attainment or how dangerous a person seems to be or how, you know, how much money they may have or whether you would want to associate with them, because you can't not be aware of those biases. Sometimes those biases turn inward, and that can reflect on the way that you cover your own community. It's not just toward other people. It can be toward people who look and act just like you.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with Joshua Johnson about his life in public media, 1A. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about what he hopes the show will do to expand the NPR audience and perhaps expand your own thinking when we come back. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're talking with 1A host Joshua Johnson about why he finds it more important to bring more light than heat to the issues of the day. And we're working in listener questions sent in early where possible. This is a pre-recorded edition of the show. Joshua, Catherine writes, since hate begins at home and we fear or hate what we don't understand, what would you think about implementing a nationwide program in elementary schools that teaches kids about diversity? It would need to be an integral part of the curriculum and as basic as saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And it could be spearheaded by an intelligent, reasonable, likable, influential person who can affect change. OMG, you're hired.
Well, thank you for offering me the job. I'm under contract to American University right now to host 1A, but I appreciate the offer. I think the key for me in terms of learning how to deal with others was learning how to view myself. I grew up in a very loving family and a very loving community. I'm so, so, so blessed to have had the upbringing I had. And I had to learn about diversity eventually. I had to learn about the travails of being a young black boy in America. But I knew I was loved unconditionally long before I knew what it meant to be black in America. Like, the first things I knew were, mommy loves you, your family loves you, God loves you, your community loves you, and no matter what happens, you can always come home. If everything goes sideways, you can always come home. That made it possible for me to learn about the rest of the world. I think diversity is, obviously, it's essential. What I am more concerned about as the host of 1A and just as a person is less how you view me and more how you view yourself. The problems that people ultimately deal with, they don't come from outside. They start from within. You know, it's if the problem is trying to be more loving or more reasonable or more empathetic, you can't give what you don't have. So I'm concerned about making sure children have empathy for themselves, that they have love for themselves, that they understand the diverse aspects of themselves before they try to talk about other people. When we talk to kids on the show, and I love interviewing children, but I try to treat them with real kid gloves and to make the interview all about them as much as possible, because they are the person they will understand the best. And I don't want them to try to extrapolate about other people, because if you're a kid and you don't know, like, that can make you feel stupid. You know, it can make you feel like you're taking a test and there's no way to get the answer right. And with regard to the pledge, remember, the pledge is also somewhat politically challenging. As of 1954, there was a little political twist that was thrown in. But I think I understand your question. My thought, based on the work that I do, is more to help young people understand who they are and talk about what they're dealing with, especially the tough stuff. Because once you can deal with your own stuff, then somebody else's stuff becomes far less frightening.
The way you interview kids and the way you talk with them, it does come through. And you don't sound like you're talking down to them. In fact, there was one interview that you did with, and I'm not going to remind you, actually. I'm not going to set up this clip. I just want to say, when I heard what you said in this moment to this person that you were interviewing, I thought, that might be the key to the universe. Let's listen.
Sometimes people don't always act the way they mean. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when a boy is acting mean, it's because there's something about you that he envies or likes and doesn't know how to deal with it. So he kicks back and he thinks, oh, I'm Sassy Squad. But he might be thinking, I wish I could do what she did. I can't. I just don't know how. I don't know how to speak up. I don't know how to raise my hand without waving like crazy, even though I don't know the answer. She's got something I don't have. And I wonder, and I don't know how best to explain that to you in any other way, but I wonder if maybe you could just cut those boys a break.
Now, you were talking to a very young Girl Scout who had initiated a confidence-boosting campaign called Raise Your Hand. And it is, that was an episode of 1A featuring Claire Shipman and Caddy
K from the
Caddy
BBC.
Caddy K of the BBC, right. Yes. They have written a couple of books about the confidence gap between men and women, how there's this gender gap. And so it was a very specific context. But as I heard you say that to her, I thought, if everybody in Washington would take those words to heart, we might completely change the tone of the dialogue on Capitol Hill.
Well, I think the reason that the girl, Alice Tapper, she was just delightful. Jake Tapper's daughter, CNN's Jake Tapper, that's his daughter. She created this merit badge to encourage girls to raise their hands in class and has sold something on the order of 6,000 of them as a fundraiser. She's really a remarkable little girl, but she's still a little girl. And I got to a moment in the interview where I felt like she was doing okay, but I knew she was nervous. So I just wanted to talk at her for a minute, which typically I don't do, but I just wanted to give her a minute to be engaged without having to produce an answer.
Yeah.
And so we talked a little bit about boys and about the nature of how people don't always do what they mean. And just to let her know, like, you have something special that some people are going to be jealous about. And I think that it seemed like it kind of opened her up. She was like, oh, okay. She didn't feel like she had to constantly produce answers. But the point is still, I think, valid with regard to human behavior.
When people are mean to us.
Yeah. It ain't always about you. It ain't
always
about you. It may be about you reflecting. I knew a friend of mine, his Twitter profile says, people throw rocks at things that shine. And it's true. Sometimes when you find yourself under attack, there's nothing wrong with you. There might be something wrong with them.
At the WHQR annual luncheon on Friday, you were the speaker. And one of the things that you said was, if you actually asked the crowd, because that's what you do, you ask questions. Mm. If you had to treat everybody in the world by the same standard, and you had to decide on what that standard is, what would it be? And you let that question hang in the air. I want to know, what is the standard for you?
I try to, well, I mean, it's part of it's just the golden rule. Treat people the way I'd like to be treated. I try to treat everyone with a sense of welcome. I try to treat everyone with a very come as you are, feel free kind of sense. I try to treat people the way we treated people when we had dinner at our house, you know, because we would lay out the food at our house. My mother and my grandmother would make a lot of food. And then no matter who they were, my grandmother would say, we're going to say grace and y'all just serve yourself. Whatever you want, just get up and get it. So just feel free. Just serve yourself and make yourself feel comfortable. So I grew up without a lot of airs. I grew up without a lot of fancy schmancy. Like, I don't do highfalutin well. I never really have. So I just try to treat people like, you know, you're a guest. I'm a host and you're a guest. And I try to treat people like guests in the truest sense of a word to a host. And I try to make it clear that I want to know you, but I don't want to malign you in the process. I want you to walk out of here knowing that you had a chance to speak as much of your truth as possible, but that I have a job to do and I have to ask difficult questions. So ultimately, I just try to treat everybody like they were a random guest off the street with something super important to say.
Has there been a time when you knew you were having a guest come in that you had a visceral negative reaction to, or you knew you were going to have that visceral negative reaction? You really had to kind of talk yourself down or talk yourself into staying curious or staying respectful?
Probably. I'm trying to think of who that would have been. I'm not sure.
And go ahead and name them, you know.
Well, I mean, it's out there. It's public record now. I'm just not sure who that would have been. We've had some guests who were very weird, who were just hard to wrangle, but not because they were bad. It's just because they were spacey. But I can't recall having a guest that I just had a really negative visceral reaction to. There haven't been many. Usually when I have a negative reaction to a guest, it's because they're being rude on the air. It's not because of who they are, but it's because they, for example, decided that they felt like turning this into a sparring match. And I don't do that. And I had to kind of correct them live on the air and say, listen, I'm the moderator. You will answer my questions. And if you don't like the questions I'm asking, and if you can't deign to be polite, hit the bricks. We're going to go on without you. That's about as unpleasant as it's gotten, and it's never gone beyond that. But I think the blessing of my work is that whoever the guest is, no matter how difficult they are, at the end of the hour, they're gone. We never have to invite them back again. Like, I'm going to be here tomorrow. So why am I going to let my interview with you be the hill that I die on? That's just stupid. Like, do your thing. I just need to give you enough room to expose how – you know, low you are, and let that be your story. I'm still going to treat you decent, whether you treat me decent or not. And then, you know, we move on.
So what's the practice that non-journalists, you're doing this on a professional, national, international stage, really, and this is your job, but we often bemoan the loss of civility in politics and public discourse. We point to our politicians on Capitol Hill and say it's their fault, that's what they're doing. But the reality is, all of us do that in some way in our lives, whether it's staying in the silo of social media and our own political echo chambers, not challenging our own thinking, not going to Thanksgiving dinner because we can't handle the other side of the family's politics.
Yeah.
So there's got to be some value in getting through that and in practicing civil discourse on an individual basis.
Yeah, it's not – and, you know, don't give me too much credit because I'm a professional. I mean, I have to do it well because I'm a professional, but I wouldn't have gotten to this point if these weren't the values with which I was raised. Like, I didn't just develop this in 2016 to get this job. Like, this is who I am, and this
so
is how
do you
I this
do
is how
it?
I was raised.
Then so you're sitting in this moment, and this person says something that you find either so vile or politically charged, and you feel that flare up in your viscera. How do you get a hold of that and take that to a constructive place? What happens next? What needs to happen in your brain?
You lean in. You lean into it. I'm going to recommend a book. We had her on the show. She's wonderful. Brené Brown. We did an hour about her book, Braving the Wilderness. And one of the chapters in her book is called People Are Hard to Hate Close Up. Lean in. Those indicators are a big sign that you need to inquire and not evade. If someone – now, there are always examples of things that people can say that are just over the line. And I would never tell someone it's your responsibility to put up with disrespect and derision. No, it's really not. But there comes a time when someone says something that's just stunning. And it stuns you because it hurts, or it stuns you because it shocked you. But even if you just take that first step and go, wait, what? Expand on that. You'd be amazed what comes out. Often people will throw those things out there because they figure it's like the sucker punch, right? You get hit with a sucker punch, and then all of a sudden, and you hit the ground, and then the referee comes, 1, 4, 8, 9, 10, you're out, and it's over. But if you can just kind of, if you can endure that sucker punch and throw back that question, or just say, expand on that, like elaborate, it's amazing how it'll often fall apart.
So you're
saying, often nothing behind the sucker punch but bravado. And once you expose that, then once their secret weapon is a dud, then you can get down to some real conversation. Like, I know you just said that to get a rise out of me. You don't have that much power. Be gone. You have no power here. Now answer my question before I drop a house on you. Like, you find a way around that tactic. Because when people do that, they're often doing it because they're scared. Like, I'm used to people like you who don't like people like me, and you won't listen, and you won't treat me right anyway, so I'm just going to sucker punch you and walk away because you're not someone I want to deal with anyway. And if you have the stamina, if you have the ability, if you have the presence of mind to parry that attack and say, elaborate, I want to know where you're coming from, and mean it, it is amazing how quickly those arguments fold like a cheap suit, and then you get down to the real stuff.
During our mic check, I asked you a question that I often ask guests, and it's deliberately off topic so that we're not rehearsing the interview.
Okay.
I asked you who in the world, living or dead, you would have dinner with tonight if you could. And after you said you'd have dinner with your mother, and
right.
She said, what are you kidding me? You can have dinner with me anytime.
Just fly home, we'll have
come
dinner
on.
Later.
You know, yeah, you then said, I would have dinner with Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why.
Because no one knows him. Like, he is an unknown person, and dinner is about getting to know somebody. And this is a man who, forget about the nuclear deal, like forget about the whole North Korea, South Korea, like take that off the table. Even if that was not a factor, this is a guy whose whole world conception has been written by him. Like, he has been able to drive the whole narrative. He's the third generation of his family, whose entire life story has been written by him and his sycophants. There is no one in the world, except maybe like Dennis Rodman, who's ever gotten to see him up close and told the story. He's just kind of like, you know, a pudgy guy with thick glasses, really, when you get down to it. He's not very robust. He's not very interesting. He may not be very bright in conversation, or he could be fascinating and charming and erudite and thoughtful and smart. I would just like to know him as a person. I delight in breaking down those facades and just giving people an unguarded moment. And I wouldn't interview him either. We would just, like, eat. We would just have dinner and shoot the breeze and see where it goes. I would just like to see him as a person.
Jim writes, have you heard back from Tom Hanks regarding his hosting the show for a week?
Oh, not yet. But I think that would be an interesting experiment. Tom was a really fun, he's a great interview. Maybe someday. And Tom, if you're out there, my number is 202-885. No, we'll see.
That's this edition of Coastline. Joshua Johnson, what a pleasure and an honor to have you with us today.
My pleasure, Rachel. Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.